From PRI and WNYC, this is the podcast of Studio 360, Public Radio's premier program about creativity, pop culture, and the arts, hosted by Kurt Anderson. This podcast can be heard weekly on public radio stations across America. Visit studio360.org to find out more. Studio 360's podcast is supported by Herman Miller and Design Within Reach, working together to foster a greater appreciation of authentic modern designs for the home.
So it was the late 1960s, and a singer in England named Vashti Bunyan had just been discovered by the manager of the Rolling Stones. She even recorded a single that had been written by Mick Jagger and Keith Richards.
Why does the sky turn gray every night?
But when Vashti got a chance to make her own debut album, it flopped big time.
Just another diamond day, just a blade of grass.
So she decided to escape to rural Scotland.
And I thought, oh dear, I've made a big mistake. I should leave it behind me. And that's what I did.
What Vashti didn't realize was that over the next 35 years, new generations of fans were worshipping that big commercial failure of hers.
This is exactly what I wanted when I was 19 years old. And now I'm 61.
Topsy-turvy stories from the marketplace of culture ahead in Studio 360 right after this. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. I just got back from an amazing trip to Tanzania and South Africa with my family. It was astonishing, really, truly magical. From our room, we could see crocodiles in the river, and we woke up before dawn every morning and headed out into the bush to find herds of elephants and troops of baboons and prides of lions. It was so not like my regular life in New York, which I had put almost entirely behind me. I didn't read papers. I didn't go online. I did bring a bit of summer reading to pass the time. I'd been sent an advance copy of a new novel called Special Topics in Calamity Physics by someone named Marisha Pessel. So in the middle of the day, when it was too hot to go out and look at animals, I'd sit in my nice air-conditioned room and read. I enjoyed the book immensely, so much so that the only message I relayed back to the office while I was gone was to try to get the author onto this show. And so until I returned to America at the end of August and finally broke out of my vacation haze, only then did I realize that the critical establishment had, in my absence, come to agree with me wholeheartedly about the book. Special Topics in Calamity Physics has gotten rave review after rave review in all kinds of press. What's more, it is Marisha Pessel's very first book. Marisha, welcome to Studio 360.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
So now you have not only written this big, wise, delightful novel that is both literary and entertaining, it's also selling well. I noticed this morning that it's number 3 among novels on Amazon.com.
Oh.
And you got a great big advance, and you're only 28 years old. How do you feel about all of the chatter around the book that is not about the book, but about you and what you look like or how much money you got?
Well, I try not to listen to it, though it certainly is hard because occasionally it's part of the interviewer's questions. But I really...
Like now.
I mean, well, one of the things I was drawn to as a novelist is that you're only as good as what you create. So first and foremost, I want people to respond to the book, and whether it be positively or negatively, I want that to be paramount in people's minds. I mean, of course, we live in a culture where we're constantly disseminating information about not only what the art is, but who is creating that, whether it's a singer or actor. But a novelist is supposed to be somewhat reclusive and behind the work. So though all of that is par for the course, my aim is that the book stands in people's minds, and that's what's addressed first.
The book is a lot of things. It's a teenage coming-of-age story. It's a political historical mystery. And it's the story of this singular and powerful father-daughter relationship. Which of those came first for you as you were conceiving this book?
I originally conceived it with the father and daughter. I always start with character. And, well, I say always because I've written previously two other books that were sort of works in progress while I was in college. So the father and the daughter, Blue and Gareth, really came principally. And then I was stricken by the image of the last 20 pages of the novel. And then the plot really evolved out of that as to how to get to that particular point.
I was going to ask you, did you know the ending from the beginning? And obviously,
exactly,
you did.
Exactly, I did. I did. I mean, I had made the, with these other two disastrous novels that I was just talking about, I'd made the mistake of not knowing where I was going and doing that writing. So I learned my lesson. And I now when I sit down to write, I want to have a very clear idea of where it's going. So then with the actual writing, I can concentrate on the sentence-by-sentence level and worry about language and really take my time.
Now, I've said that it's a mystery, that it's a father-daughter relationship. When you are asked, what is this book about? What is your 25 words or less answer?
Well, I have a 10-word answer.
Good.
That says that I think I've taken that from reviews. It's a coming-of-age literary mystery. But it is, I think it is really about books and how the books we read shape our reality in ways both beneficial and destructive, and how literature helps us order the world and fill in the blanks for the truths that we might potentially never be able to figure out. So that really is Blue's trajectory in the book.
She's 16. She's a 16-year-old high school senior for most of the book.
Yes.
But at 16, Blue is just terrifyingly well-read. And every time she mentions a book, whether it's real or made up, she includes the author and the publication date as if she's writing an academic paper. And you also name each of your chapters after a well-known
yes.
book. Were you, as a 16-year-old or a 12-year-old, that insanely bookocentric and literate?
Not at all. I mean, I was reading constantly, but my reading list was nowhere near as esoteric as hers. I was reading, well, probably at 16, I was just getting into probably Huck Finn, and I think I was assigned The Scarlet Letter. So at that age, I was. But no, I mean, where Blue was reading Dickens, I was reading Nancy Drew and
Phew.
and Misty of Shincon Teague and all of those books. I loved animal stories. So, but no. But in terms of Blue, I mean, books were a part of my childhood. My mother read aloud to my sister and I To Kill a Mockingbird and a lot of those childhood classics.
I'd love to hear something from it, if you could read a piece for us.
Sure. Dad picked up women the way certain wool pants can't help but pick up lint. For years I had a nickname for them, though I feel a little guilty using it now. June bugs. See Fig Eater Beetle, Ordinary Insects, Volume 24. There was Mona Latrovsky, the actress from Chicago with wide-set eyes and dark hair on her arms, who liked to shout, "Gareth, you're a fool," with her back to him. Dad's cue to run over to her, turn her around, and see the look of bitter longing on her face. Only Dad never turned her around to see the bitter longing. Instead, he stared at her back as if it was an abstract painting. Then he went into the kitchen for a glass of bourbon. There was Connie Madison Parker, whose perfume hung in the air like a battered piñata. There was Zula Pierce of Oak Cush, New Mexico, a black woman who was taller than he was, so whenever Dad kissed her, she had to bend down as if peeking through a peephole to see who was ringing her bell. She started out calling me Blue Honey, which, like her relationship with Dad, slowly began to erode, becoming Blue Honey and then Blue-oni, ultimately ending with Baloney. Baloney had it in for me from the very beginning, she screamed.
That was Marisha Pessel reading from her novel Special Topics in Calamity Physics. A friend of mine who's a novelist, a very good novelist, said to me years ago that she thinks that every novel is a mystery. And that's always struck me as an interesting way of thinking about books. And I wonder if you thought of this as a mystery novel from the get-go.
I did, in the sense, and I actually like what your friend said a lot, because I decided that I was going to write it from this first-person narrative, Blue Van Meer, and it was going to be her telling the story of her life. I was inspired by Robert Browning's poem, My Last Duchess, and the idea of this very unreliable narrator and having that narrative truth, or Blue's truth, be very different from the one I as an author knew to be happening, and how the interplay of that and eventually peeling away those layers, and inevitably that mystery forms.
The title, Special Topics in Calamity Physics, other than being a kind of humorously ponderous academic-sounding title, has nothing to do with this book, really.
Well, this is what Blue has chosen to sort of define her life in terms, and she's following in her father's footsteps in terms of writing down this story and structuring it like a syllabus, because he, of course, was teaching political science all across the country and was always coming up with these wild course parameters and reading lists. So she's following in his footsteps in that regard. But I also think that it's her way of addressing, and I think this is actually something we all do in terms of looking back at our past and trying and putting a frame around it, which is one of the conceits mentioned in the introduction, and trying to analyze it and formulate hypotheses as to why we did X or Y, when in fact the truth is a lot more murky than that. But it's something we all try to do. So
you were writing previous novels before you started this one in college. Did you, from age 17, know that you wanted to be a novelist?
No, I didn't, actually. My mother was a newspaper writer in my hometown of Asheville, North Carolina, and she also wrote stories. And she had an old typewriter, this old Smith Corona, and I remember as a very young child, I would write alongside her in her study. And I think throughout my life, I was just always writing, but I thought I wanted to be an actress. And then after college, I went into financial consulting at PricewaterhouseCoopers. But again and again, I came back to the writing and was always working on this. And so eventually I just gave in to those urges and sat down and with some discipline started writing special topics.
So you have this big, successful, in every sense, book. Does it give you agita to think about, oh, my God, now my second book? What can I do to follow up this strong debut?
No, it doesn't. I mean, I think of, I was actually listening to John Updike the other day, and he's inspiring in the sense that he's always writing and he always comes out with something else. And he doesn't seem to be fazed with what the reaction is because he's a writer. And I feel the same way. I mean, occasionally, you're going to be writing books that are more popular than others, but as long as you enjoy the process and you're speaking to some audience and some people respond to it, then that's all in your hands. And you have to write the books that you're excited by and not worry so much about it.
And are you excited by one?
I am, but I can't talk about it. I am. I'm starting my next, and I'm excited by it, actually, yeah.
Marisha Pessl, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Marisha Pessl's first novel, Special Topics in Calamity Physics, is for sale everywhere right now.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about a science book. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that
in a minute. It no longer phases us when a Picasso sells for $10 or $100 million, but that piece of art in the gallery that is supposedly worth $10,000 and then the one next to it is worth $1,000. How do they decide that?
The work was priced at $2,000, $2,200, and a lot of pieces sold because the price was not a hurdle to overcome.
That's just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Herman Miller and Design Within Reach, working together to foster a greater appreciation of authentic modern designs for the home. Product information available online at dwr.com/360.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. We just heard a minute ago from a young writer, Marisha Pessl, who's making waves in the literary world with her first novel. But For any young creative person, whether they're a writer or painter or musician, sussing out the marketplace can be baffling and daunting and downright scary. Take the art world. Why do paintings cost what they cost? Who makes the decision that one work of art by a relatively unknown artist sells for thousands of dollars while another one for hundreds or not at all? Sarah Elsis recently explored the gallery scene in the ultra-hipster art neighborhood of Williamsburg in Brooklyn, looking for some kind of answer to that question.
It's pretty rare in the art world for people to talk openly about prices. Tatiana Ochstein, the owner of the Black and White Gallery, is an exception.
When I'm interested in an artist, my very first question is, have you sold any work at all to anybody? And so far, everybody's sold something to a friend, to father, whatever. But it gives me a really good indication of what people were willing to pay for, like, totally unknown work of art.
The artists who show at the Black and White Gallery are often right out of art school. Customers range from older collectors to first-time art buyers, like this young attorney.
I love some of these. They're absolutely beautiful. I could see some of these in my apartment.
Tatiana emigrated from the Soviet Union in 1980. She worked as an investment banker for 20 years until 2001.
9/11, that was a catalyst event for me. My office was just across the street from the World Trade Center, and I pretty much came home in the evening, and I said, I'm not going back there.
She opened her gallery the next year. Tatiana's attracted to art that has layers, that takes time to understand.
I like work that is more, as I tell people, more like Hitchcock than Frankenstein. I'm interested in young people who are really thinking about the world around them, about their relationship to that world.
My name is Megan Foster, and I show at the Black and White Art Gallery. I make sort of graphic interiors. They're sort of have a look of architectural line drawings. And they're acrylic paintings on canvas.
In the spring of 2002, Megan was finishing up her MFA at Columbia. Tatiana came to her final thesis show and fell in love with the paintings. She gave Megan her first solo show at the Black and White Gallery later that year.
The work was priced at $2,200, and a lot of pieces sold because the price was not a hurdle to overcome for people who just like the work.
It's a nice bonus check when you make some money from your paintings, and then if you have a show that sells out, then your career increases and the prices increase.
In 2005, it was her second solo show, and the work was priced for twice that amount, $5,000, $5,500. The idea is to create the demand for artist work. And the lower you start, I think the faster you can create that demand because the work goes into multiple hands and people see it in those homes, in those apartments, and people talk about it. And that's how it goes. It's viral.
Perhaps the biggest effect on the price of art is the dealer's cut, usually 50%. That may seem high, but dealers not only need to pay rent and run marketing campaigns, they take charge of their artists' careers. And Tatiana says that artists can't do this on their own.
It's impossible to create and do the business side. If some people claim that they can do it, they're either bad artists or bad business people.
Luring Augustine.
Across the river in Manhattan, the Luring Augustine Gallery is a bit more established than the Black and White. They represent top artists like Rachel Whiteread. She's a sculptor known for her plaster and resin casts of things like entire rooms and water towers. Roland Augustine has been running his Chelsea Gallery for 20 years.
Most of the artists that we work with have been artists that we've worked with from the beginning of their careers, such as Rachel Whiteread. I think we've done five one-person shows of Rachel's work in the past 15 or 16 years, and the prices have gradually increased to significant price levels.
The price of an artist's work must always go up. Otherwise, collectors start looking elsewhere. An artist who starts out in a gallery like the Black and White, selling for under $10,000, ideally moves up in the gallery food chain and ends up somewhere like Luring Augustine. Take Rachel Whiteread. Roland Augustine and his partner first saw her work at a group show at a London gallery.
We offered to include work of hers in a group show and then actually hosted a one-person show of her work in New York and began our rapport. A work of art that was sold 16 years ago to a museum for, let's say, $35,000 would probably be selling in the vicinity of $350,000 today, because of the fact that we have done our jobs correctly in terms of getting her work into the right collections and helping to manage her career properly.
And that's the gallerist's job. They get collectors and museums excited about their artists.
I sort of think of gallery owners in the way I think of participants in the financial markets.
Will Getzman is an economics professor at Yale who studies art markets. He says that an art dealer is very much like an investment banker during an initial public offering.
The investment banker really has to define why this company is such a great thing to buy and how you might actually value it in relation to other kinds of firms.
For Tatiana, the former investment banker turned gallerist, this is right up her alley.
With collectors, I become like this transformer of that energy from the artist through my own sort of understanding of where this artist is and where he or she can be placed in the current sort of map of the art world, and hint on the potential of that artist.
It's that potential and its subjective nature that makes the pricing of art seem so mysterious. But Will Getzman says that it isn't.
We like to put art up as that one aspect of modern life that is separated from the market. But of course it's not.
I walk around and look at the pieces that I like and try to figure out, is that something that I'd like in my home? And the next question is, how much does that cost and can I get it? How much could I easily write a check for? $700.
There really seems to be no formula. A painting is something that's bought and sold like a pair of shoes or an apartment. And prices fluctuate in very much the same way, based on the economy or on what's in style.
When I open a show and all of a sudden the word starts spreading around that this is a hot artist, I cannot explain why it happens. But when it happens, it's great.
For Studio 360, I'm Sarah Elzis.
Your loving gave me such a thrill, but your loving don't pay my bills. I need money, that's what I want. Give me money.
You can find out more about the pricing of art on our website, studio360.org. Speaking of the cultural marketplace and its sometimes old-fashioned habits, I recently heard about two young entrepreneurs who are almost single-handedly transforming the business of little theater and dragging their rivals into the 21st century. It used to be that if you were a playwright and you wanted to publish the script of your play so people could perform it, you had to go with one of two very old firms, the Samuel French Company or the Dramatists Play Service. But now that has changed, thanks to a new company called PlayScripts Incorporated. I talked with the two brothers who started PlayScripts when they were college students, Doug and Jonathan Rand, and asked them how it all began.
I guess it started when I was in high school. I wrote a play, was eventually published by a traditional publisher, and I thought I was doing great. And then Jonathan comes along, not to be outdone. He's 3 years younger than me, and he writes a play in high school. While he's waiting to hear back from the publishers, like a good playwright, he had put some scenes from his play up on his homepage. And if you did a Yahoo search for one-act comedy, John's play was one of the first things that would pop up. And people would email him, and so he would just do it himself. He'd, you know, email them the script, charge them $25 a pop to do the play. And we kept getting emails from Jonathan saying, oh, you know, they're doing my play in Ohio next weekend. Or, they're doing my play in Europe. They're doing my play in this Taiwan girl school. They're doing my play in Kyrgyzstan. It just got more and more ridiculous until after a year, having spent absolutely no money, he had licensed well over 100 productions in 12 countries.
And were you aware at the time how amazing that was for being an unpublished play that was getting produced all over the world?
Definitely when it started getting done at, you know, an all-girls Taiwanese school, I started to wonder what was going on.
It's what just, is the play, by the way, that these Taiwanese girls have performed?
It's actually an all-Taiwanese cast. No, it's called Hard Candy, and it's a series of job interviews gone horribly wrong.
How do you go from saying, hey, this is a good idea, it's worked for Jonathan, to saying to America's hundreds of unproduced and unpublished playwrights, this is a new model?
Well, it started out very homegrown.
I mean, you know, anyone we'd ever met or knew through our very nascent playwriting careers, we just sent out an email saying, hey, send us some work. And I think our initial catalog, when we launched it in March 2000, had 8 plays.
And how many plays and playwrights are there now?
There are over 550 plays by almost 300 playwrights. So what we eventually hit on was these encrypted script samples. I mean, that's what we're still using now. If you go to the PlayScripts website, playscripts.com, you'll see that every play in our catalog, you can read 80 to 90% of the script for free anytime, day or night, but you can't copy and paste it. You can't print it out. It's frozen on your computer screen, and if you want to see what happens at the end or if you want to license a production, you've got to kick it in traditional mode and actually buy some books.
Now, you have this pretty extraordinary gold standard advisory board with Tony Kushner and Terrence McNally and Neil Simon and Alfred Uhry. At what point were you able to convince these titans of the American theater that they should add their imprimaturs to your little operation?
Right when the company was starting in 2001, which was about a year after we got started, Harold Prince was giving a talk at Penn.
And the famous producer-director Hal Prince.
Correct.
Yes. But we explained the whole concept, and he got it immediately. Then what happened was what we only dreamed of. He said, I really like what you're doing. What can I do for you? And we said, we're starting an advisory board. We'd love it if you could be on our advisory board. He said, absolutely. Okay, what else can I do for you? And we said,
we want to grow the advisory board. You know. And so he said, you know, give me a wish list. And so not everybody in the advisory board that you see today is from Harold Prince, but a good chunk of it.
Not everybody in the theater establishment was on your side at the beginning, were they?
Correct.
Edward Albee, for instance, was an enemy.
We didn't know. We were just very excited by the possibility we're going to meet Edward Albee. You know, we've never met him before. We've only told him the bare minimum about PlayScripts. We have no idea what background he has knowing about our company. Put my hand out. I say, you know, Mr. Albee, it's a pleasure to meet you. I'm Doug. This is John. We're with PlayScripts, Inc. And he says, so you're the gentleman who want to destroy copyright.
Which is, of course, the first thing you want to hear as somebody
yes.
who admires Edward Albee.
And who just started a fledgling company.
Right.
Now, like the guy who runs Hair Club for Men, Jonathan, in addition to owning the company, you're a client.
I am a client.
I read, in fact, on the website that you have written 3 of the top 5 most produced plays in American high schools.
Yeah, it's sort of wild. Yeah, yes.
Hard Candy, Check Please, and a play called The Least Offensive Play in the Whole Darn World. Why are your plays so popular? Just because PlayScripts is promoting the hell out of them? Or
I don't know. I think that I wrote Hard Candy when I was 17, and I didn't really have any designs on how I would market the play. It was just I was writing a play that I thought my friends would have a good time performing in high school. So by chance, and you know, you could say this is the reason why we exist right now as a company, by chance I wrote this play that happened to have a large cast that happened to be episodic, that got everyone involved and not really have a lead role.
Without realizing it, Jonathan had sort of hit this sweet spot. A large cast, short play, ensemble-based, PG-13. Every really quality play we've published that fits those parameters has been done regularly at schools all across
the world. Well, I noticed the shortness of your plays. They're all 20 or 30 or 40 minutes. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the plays on PlayScripts. Being a theater goer in New York, yes, you go to occasional festivals of one acts, but you think of a play being at least 90 minutes, if not much longer. It's as though there's a parallel universe of theater out there that you guys have figured out how to tap.
Playwrights don't really know about this market, and they're not writing these plays, and their agents are not telling them to write these plays. And yet there are only a few hundred huge professional theaters out there, and there are tens of thousands of high schools out there, and so many of them are going to these festivals where they have to set up to perform the play and strike the set within 45 minutes.
That's the rule. If you go over, you're disqualified.
So they need these plays.
Well, it's interesting, given that most of what one hears and reads in the news media about theater is dispiriting and depressing, you seem to embody a sort of great, hopeful surge.
Well, we're young yet. We'll probably get grizzled in a few years.
Good. Well, you can come back and tell me how it's all failed in a few years. But I think not. I really, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Thank you.
You can find out more about PlayScripts, Inc. on our website, studio360.org. Special thanks to Julian Russo. In any branch of the culture industry, there's always tension between the old and the new, the up-and-coming and the established. Back in the 1960s, a scruffy teenager in Britain named Vashti Bunyan was kicked out of art school because she was playing too much guitar. So she began wandering around London and was discovered by the manager of the Rolling Stones and suddenly found herself schmoozing with the big names of the day. Vashti even recorded a single of a Rolling Stones song backed by an orchestra.
Why does the sky turn gray every night? Sunrise again in time.
But the single and her music career didn't go anywhere. She was crushed. Vashti decided to move up to rural Scotland, where she thought she'd left the pop music scene forever. And she went up there with a horse and buggy.
I guess it just seemed like the only thing to do. It seemed sensible. Well, I needed a roof, so a caravan was good. I didn't have any money for petrol, so a horse was good. I needed to move up to Scotland, so I needed transport. So horse, caravan seemed to make sense. And it took two whole summers and a winter to get there. And in the meantime, I'd written some songs. Not with any idea of recording them, but I just didn't stop. I didn't stop singing and writing. But then I met Joe Boyd halfway through the journey, who had produced people like Nick Drake and the Incredible String Band and Fairport Convention and John Martin. And he said he would like to make an album of the songs sort of to document the journey by the time we'd finished the journey. And he kept his promise. And we went back down to London and I recorded Just Another Diamond Day.
Just another diamond day, just a blade of grass, just another bit of hay, and the horses pass. La 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 la.
By the time it came out at the end of 1970, that little bit of time where a pastoral album could have worked just didn't at all. Small, quiet songs that sounded a bit like nursery rhymes, really, to a lot of people's ears, just didn't have a place at all. Our electronic music, experimental music had taken off. And, of course, if I'd stayed in London, I would have probably gone along with all of that. Because my life was a pastoral life, that was what came out in the songs.
Just another life to live, just a word to say. Just another love to give and a diamond day.
After the record came out, I had a baby by then, and my life had changed completely. And I felt that the record didn't represent me in any way. It sounded too much as if it had been recorded around a campfire or in a room somewhere. And also because there were only very few pressed, and the reviews that it did get were not very kind about it. And I thought, oh dear, I've made a big mistake. I'm not really a musician. I'm not good enough for this. I should leave it behind me. And that's what I did for 30 years. Didn't play at all. Not at all. If I ever thought, it would be really nice to play that guitar that's hanging up on the wall there gathering dust, and I would take it down and I would try to play it. But the sounds that came out were the sounds of the album and the sounds of the songs before that had been such a terrible failure for me. And so I was just too overcome with sadness about it, and so I just put it back up on the wall. I wanted to write the story of the journey for the children. And of course, getting a computer led me to the internet, which led me to a site that I looked at about the Incredible String Band. And there was a message on there saying, does anybody know what happened to Vashti Bunyan? She made one album in 1970 and hasn't been heard of since. Where is she? And so I wrote back to that person, and he was in Sacramento. He'd bought the album in 1970 in Sacramento. How did it get there? It never came out in this country. But anyway, he led me to other sites on the internet that mentioned the album and all the singles and all the songs that I thought were lost forever. They had come out on compilation CDs here and there. And also there was a bootleg of Just Another Diamond Day. And when I listened to one of those, it was so bad and there were bits missing out of all the songs and it was obviously copied from a very scratched vinyl. I thought, well, if it's going to be out there, it better be out there in the form in which it was meant to be.
Winter is blue, living is gone.
So that had the effect of making me reclaim it and look for the master tapes, and we found them and I got the rights back and we reissued the album in 2000.
Love will not find even one more new morning.
It was really shocking. It was really shocking because I had convinced myself that I'd never existed in a musical world at all. And there it was on the screen. It was quite a feeling. It was such a different response this time, and I can't explain it in any way. The reviews were lovely, and I couldn't believe my eyes when I was reading these words about, I'm thinking, is this the same album they're talking about? Why? Why now? 35 years later, 36 years later, oh dear. When I read what people say about it, I think, well, yes, that's what I meant. Well, it had the effect of having me write again and play the guitar again. When I picked up the guitar, it didn't sound terrible and old and dusty and long and forgotten and disappointing and full of regret. It felt alive again. The songs on Just Another Diamond Day are mostly about looking forward and about dreaming of the future. The songs on the new album, Look Aftering, are more about looking back and trying to make sense of the time in between and what I've been doing.
Once I had a child, she was smiling like sunshine.
I was walking along the road in London the other day, where I grew up, and realised that I was on my way to an interview. I'm thinking, this is exactly what I wanted when I was 19 years old. And now I'm 61 and this is happening to me now. This is completely upside down and totally ridiculous, but wow. It's very, very good.
Then I had a child, took his wild like northern summer, and he knows it all.
Vashti Bunyan made and released a second album last year, and she is on tour in the United States right now. You can find out more about her on our website, studio360.org. Coming up next, a mild-mannered art photographer takes on the Ku Klux Klan.
My feeling, my argument is, how can I turn a blind eye to racial prejudice and injustice?
William Christenberry is just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is made possible by Herman Miller and Design Within Reach, offering the Eames Aluminum Group and soft pad chairs with seat back suspension and aluminum frames designed for home and office. Product information is available online at dwr.com/360.
Thank you. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. The American Art Museum in Washington, D.C. recently opened a retrospective of one of my favorite of the great living photographers in America, William Christenberry. Christenberry grew up in the 1940s and early 50s in central Alabama near Tuscaloosa. A half century later, he still returns to Hale County every year to chronicle the very slowly morphing rural landscape of his childhood. The faded wooden barns, the kudzu-covered buildings, the dilapidated roadside markets with rusty signs, a certain old barbecue joint. But even with such very familiar, iconic images of the South, Christenberry brilliantly avoids cliché. And he's here with me today to talk about how and why he does what he does. William Christenberry, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you very much.
So you live and teach not in the South or the Deep South, but Washington, D.C., and yet your body of work is all about this fairly small patch of Alabama. Why is that, and why do you keep returning?
I don't think there is an easy answer to that, except I tell people when asked similar question, that's where my heart still is. I became infatuated with that landscape and the things in the landscape, especially the vernacular architecture and many of the traditions.
But your heart is there. You love it. You love looking at it, obviously, and lovingly chronicling it, but you don't want to live there.
My feeling about that is if I lived there, I don't know if I would see it as clearly. And as it's seen in my work so often, going back to the same places time after time, and watching them decay or change or disappear.
And do you drive there from Washington?
Yes. I've made that trek every year without a miss since 1968. For a long time, it was with children. They're grown now, and I make the trek by myself. It's approximately 806 miles to Tuscaloosa and down into Hale County at another 15 or 20. And now I'm adamant about keeping the string intact because if everything goes well and it's still there, I will make the annual picture of the Red Building and Forest.
Now, you're talking about the little red building that is pictured on the cover of your gorgeous new book. The building is very simple, made of what looks like some kind of glazed red brick. It's in the middle of a wooded glade. It has a bricked-up door, which makes the whole image mysterious and sort of funny. What were you trying for?
Well, I should tell you how I discovered it. I like to take back roads and just see what I might stumble upon. In 1974, to be exact, I came across this little building, and I call it the Red Building in Forest. And I didn't know for a long time its function until I met a local judge in the county, and who became a friend of mine. And be honest with you, he is one of the people there who is very interested in what I do. Some people think what I do with the camera or in my sculpture and drawing is being critical of Alabama. That's not true. The large portion of my work is celebratory.
I find it incredibly loving for the most part.
Well, I appreciate that because some people, why does he like that old junk? Why didn't he photograph some of those antebellum mansions? They're too pristine. They're too, I guess in a way, perfect. But just a few years ago, I was there, and there was a mobile home, a flat-top, aluminum-sided building parked right in the front of it, and it ruined my vantage point with the camera. A few months later, I'm there, actually when my father passed, and at his wake, this young judge in the county came up to me to express his condolences. And I said, Judge Ryan, I don't know if you're aware of the Red Building in Forest. He said, matter of fact, I was by there the other day and I thought of you. I said, did you notice there's a mobile home parked right in front of it now? He said, yes. And I said innocently but rather firmly, is there anything you could do about that? And I'm going to say it the way he said it. See what I can do. See what I can do. So I come back to Washington. A couple of weeks go by. One day, the phone rang. I'm working in the studio. And I answered and said, Bill, it's Sonny. His name is William Ryan, and people call him Sonny. And I said, Judge, I can't call a judge Sonny. Anyway, he said, it's gone. And before I could say, he said, I had it moved just like you requested. Not only did we move the flat-top metal building from the front of the red building, we planted grass on the spot where it sat so it would be ready for you when you come back next summer. My point is you have to have friends in high places.
Well, it reminds me of the fact, here you are using a local judge to manipulate your images, that in the show I saw here in New York at the Aperture Gallery, you have photographs of signs, of vernacular, homemade, home-painted signs, and then you'll have one of the signs there next to the picture. How does that work?
Well, I hope it's okay to say this on your program, but I appropriate those in many different ways. And some people might frown on some of the methods, but seriously, oftentimes the building is nothing there, as people could care less. Most of the time I would ask the store owner, if there was someone there, would you part with that or what would you take for that? And invariably they say, you like that old thing? Just take it, son.
Well, it's not only wonderful as a viewer to see the real things, but it's interesting to me that as I look at the work, you mix it up with the real junk.
The real junk has become a part of it. For example, in the show at the Smithsonian, there are 32 top snuff signs, all weathered differently, all found at different times, but it's the same sign. And it's a little tongue-in-cheek play on Mr. Warhol's 32 Campbell soup cans. But I found all of mine, see, and they're not altered at all. I don't dust them off, nothing. The more rusted weathered they are, the better.
Apropos Warhol, it's almost the opposite. Instead of being this absolutely identically reproduced pop symbol, here each one has its own little story and patina.
And in the case of the red building, that is not real brick. That's an artificial brick siding that you buy in rolls, and they would just staple or tack this up. And I think whoever did it, it could have been totally unintentional, but to make a fake brick door.
What was that building, by the way? Did you ever find out?
Good question. For many years, I had no idea. Until one year, it was in the mid-80s, I was there. And here was this metal sign on a steel post in front. It said BEAT, B-E-A-T, 13. That was my clue. It was a polling place. Before that, a long time ago, it was a one-room schoolhouse.
When you talk about schools and voting in Alabama back in the day, one naturally leads to some of the other stuff, your subjects, which is the Ku Klux Klan. You've done sculptures of hooded figures and drawings of hoods, and you took some pictures at a Klan rally, I guess, in the 60s.
Early 60s with a hidden camera.
That must be a part of depicting Alabama that the people who say you're negative about Alabama point to.
Yes, and I've been criticized for even undertaking this. But my feeling, my argument is, how can I turn a blind eye to racial prejudice and injustice? And then, lo and behold, in 1978, from my studio in Washington, right there in a nice part of town, the work was stolen and has never resurfaced. It was close to 200 objects, things I'd made that pertained to this terrible subject.
And when did that happen?
78.
How strange. Who do you think did that?
Well, what is very strange about it, to answer your question, is the door was locked back up. And on January the 1st, 79, I opened the door, and I could not believe my eyes because the work was gone, just as neat as a pin. Like, I could have better understood if it had been vandalized. It was obvious that somebody really took care. And I don't think it was the Klan.
You don't think it was a political...
I think it was somebody who wanted to possess the work in the negative sense of that word. That scares me.
And none of this work has ever shown up?
Never.
I understand that the pictures of that Klan rally that you secretly photographed that work has never been shown until now.
Not until recently. And it's not often seen because many places are fearful of exhibiting it.
Fearful of?
People's reaction. I can't repeat some of the comments written in the commentary book. They're so vile. One comment was so terrible, and it was signed Calvin Craig, KKK, College Park, Georgia. And I'm not an authority on the Klan, nor do I want to be, but there was a high-ranking official from Georgia with that name.
What would have been the other reactions? Presumably not all racist and grotesque.
Well, it's a tough piece. It's meant to be. You're not meant to be comfortable in there. The nature of these satin-clad G.I. Joe dolls, over 100 drawings, mostly from my imagination, very few photographs. It's a tableau. It's called the Klan Room.
If you ask Americans, name a photographer who has chronicled the South, the top answer would be Walker Evans, I expect. And to my great amazement, your life in a couple of ways intertwined with his.
That's a wonderful story. In 1962, the second printing of Let Us Now Praise Famous Men came out. 1960, excuse me. I had never heard of Walker Evans at that moment. I was in a bookstore in Birmingham in 1960, and there on the counter near the cash register, fresh from the publishing house in Boston, Houghton Mifflin, was this book, Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, James A.G. Walker Evans. I started thumbing through the first pages, and I realized that I knew some of the people in Walker Evans' photographs. They did not share crop from my grandparents, my mother's family, the Smith family, but they lived nearby. And they would come over to my grandparents' house and help my grandmother do washing and things like that. But when I discovered that, and then when I moved here, I knew I had read that Walker Evans was a senior editor at Fortune magazine.
So you moved to New York?
Mm-hmm. I did all kinds of things. I ended up being a file clerk in the picture collection at Time Life, and Walker Evans saw fit to help me get that position. And he and Mrs. Evans were very kind and supportive of me. But then Walker, at a later date, said, you mentioned one time in our conversation that you made color snapshots. And I said, yes, sir, I'd like to see those. Man, I was intimidated by it. Well, that's not the right word. I didn't know what to say. I was pleased, but also nervous. I had 61 of these little brownie snapshots processed at the local drugstore. And he just distanced himself completely from the conversation. Mrs. Evans and I were over there talking. And I didn't think he had ever finished looking at it. And finally, he had finished, and he turned to me. He said, young man, there's something about the way you use this little camera. It's become a perfect extension of your eye, and I suggest you take these seriously. I was about as interested in photography as I was physics, zero at that time. But I was photographing things that I knew, that I loved, that I empathized with, and nothing more.
Are there other influences on you, on your work, on your sensibility?
Certainly literature, and in more recent years, poetry.
Who do you read?
Well, one of my favorite ones now, and has been and will be forever, is Miss Emily Dickinson.
Well, of the literary forms, I can see that there's some connection between the poem and the photograph in terms of trying to do everything in a small frame.
Walker Evans wrote, I was having an exhibition in 1973, and he called me one day, and he said, I'd be hurt if I'm not asked to write something. Well, I passed out when he said that. You know, of course, I wasn't going to ever ask
him.
Amazing. But he summed it up. The last line is, and each one is a poem. And I think that's just, you know, I can't expect any higher praise.
Bill Christenberry, I want to thank you very much for coming into Studio 360 today.
Thank you very much.
Passing Time, The Art of William Christenberry, is up at the Smithsonian American Art Museum in Washington for a whole year until July of 2007. And a book of Christenberry's work has just been published by Aperture. You can find out more about him and his work at studio360.org. That's it for this week's show. Thanks very much for listening today to Studio 360. I hope you'll join us again next week. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
David Krasnow,
Lital Malad,
Michelle Siegel,
Abe Carrillo,
Derek John,
Sarah Lilly,
Eric Malinsky,
Monica Carrier,
Adam Walton,
Lori Ann Agnesi.
And our theme music is by David Van Tiegum.
Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, supporting CARE in its efforts to alleviate global poverty, on the web at care.org, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I don't need books to be explicitly about September 11th. I just need books to be explicitly about the kinds of thoughts and emotions that September 11th inspired, like fear, like family.
The novelist Jonathan Safran Foer and others on artists dealing with September 11th 5 years later. That's next time in Studio 360. from PRI.
You've been listening to Studio 360. If you'd like to hear the show in its entirety, visit studio360.org to find out when the program is broadcast on your public radio station.